This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with David Donson. He's the executive editor of Louisiana Business, Inc., and that includes the Baton Rouge Business Report. David Donson was with the Business Report when it began in 1982 with Ralph McCollister. He left Baton Rouge for 24 years and came back last year, and we'll talk with him about then and now. Also on the show, Adam Knapp, the president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, on what's going on regarding a bill that is making its way through the legislature, which would strip the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board of much of its authority. Yesterday, the board voted 9-0 against this measure, and we'll talk with Adam Knapp. And Earl Swift with a biography about a classic car, the 1957 Chevy. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest to begin is David Donson. He's the executive editor of Louisiana Business, Inc., which includes the Business Report, 225, In Register, and the Daily Report, and he is here to talk about Baton Rouge then and now. You started with Ralph McCollister in 1982, 32 short years ago, as the Business Report was in its genesis, and you left in 1989 and came back last year. But how have things changed between the 80s and contemporary Baton Rouge as we know it?
Well, I get asked that a lot, and I wonder if the question that I need to ask myself is how I've changed, because Baton Rouge is different. It's the same in some ways, but one thing that I find that seems different is this attitude of can-do and this attitude that we're really on the brink and that we've got this great thing going here, and that if we just do the right things and be smart, we're going to have a really, really special place to live.
Well, a lot of good things are happening as far as industry in Louisiana, and you worked in industry.
Yes, I did.
You left the Business Report to go to work for McGraw-Hill, which is a publishing giant, but you worked in a different capacity, right?
I was in their energy group, and we had newsletters, and I covered the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and I covered markets. So I got to see both sides, the regulatory side and where the rubber hits the road on the energy side.
Well, before we get to the last 24 years or so, what compelled you to come back?
Well, I bounced around. I did take a job in media relations in Portland, Oregon, and that company was bought by TransCanada, which was building the Keystone XL pipeline you may have heard of, and they moved me to Houston. And this summer I got a call from Rolf, and he says, I want to come back. And I said, you bet. And came back, kicked the tires, and been here ever since, loving it.
Well, you lived in Washington, D.C., in Portland, and Houston. All of those cities have advanced remarkably in the last quarter century. How is Baton Rouge compared?
In some ways, it compares very favorably. There's not the critical mass that you would find in a Houston. I mean, I realized very early on that when somebody tells you that, you're one in a million in Houston, that means there's five guys just like you walking around. So the scale is different. One of the first things I did when I came back was I went around and spoke to several business leaders. One of them was John Davies. And I caught him at a bad time. He was having a meeting with his board, and he said, you know what? Let's take a walk. And he just took me around and showed me a downtown that I had not seen in 24 years. And I was struck by how much it reminded me of Portland. The same era, there's a river runs through it, the trees, the green, but also really some pretty hip stuff going on downtown.
Baton Rouge is a bit smaller than Portland, though.
Portland's about 2.1, and we're, 700,000?
Yeah, maybe a little more than that. So about three times the size of Baton Rouge. And that, of course, is a substantial distinction. Portland would make up about half of the state of Louisiana. We're a relatively small state. We have fewer people than the metropolitan area of Houston does, where you also lived. And we've got a lot of issues, as you know. So why would you leave these spots that are considered to be progressive to come back to Baton Rouge with all its many challenges?
When I was younger, I had only lived really in Shreveport, Baton Rouge, and Lake Charles, and my perspective was pretty narrow. And I'm going to open the kimono here, as they say on the West Coast. Jim, I really had a little bit of contempt for Louisiana because, I mean, I was young. I thought I was smart. And I felt like the mantra was first and everything bad, last and everything good. But then you go around and you get a perspective from the East Coast, from the West Coast, from the Gulf Coast. And when I came back, what I found was this is a very, very special place. It's unique in the United States. You talk about a sense of place. Just walk around Baton Rouge and you know where you are. The people, the food, the music, the customs, even the language and how we approach things like dance and food. Mm-hmm. It's a special place.
297-5633. David Donson with us. He was with the Business Report when it began in 1982 and was there the first 7 years with Ralph McAllister. At that time, Pat Screen was the mayor of Baton Rouge. Edwin Edwards, for much of that period, was governor. And then Buddy Romer was elected in 1987, the Romer Revolution, which Ralph certainly played a part in. Many thought that would be the pivotal point in Louisiana's history, contemporary history. It turned out to only be a one-term governorship, though. Do you think there were some lost opportunities?
It's hard to say because I left right in the middle of it. But I was like you. I was in the camp of, wow, this is it. This is our best chance at genuine reform. But I've also discovered over the years that, as you well know, Jim, that things are the way they are typically because somebody wants them that way. And there seemed to be a much greater preponderance of folks who preferred the old way to folks who preferred the Romer Revolution.
Well, we have Governor Jindal in office now, and I think he deserves and is receiving plaudits for the economic success in the state. But there are other problems, some of which have intensified on his watch. Based on your 8 months and your return here, how do you think our governor is doing?
I think he's doing the best job he can. I think he's doing what, by his lights, what he thinks is the best thing for the state. I know he has critics, but I haven't really been around long enough to have a definitive opinion one way or the other.
And, of course, the publisher, Mr. McAllister, he's very close to the governor. At times, when J.R. Ball held your position, I'm sure he took positions that Ralph didn't agree with, but they still ended up in the magazine. So today, if you were to be in total disagreement with Mr. McAllister, which I doubt you would be, but if you were, would you be allowed to publish whatever is on your mind?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Ralph always, he never asked to see what I'm going to write. I can honestly say we've never discussed the governor. But when I do reach out to him and say, you know, I'm about to say something, he says, I trust you. So our relationship is very good.
What kind of thought went into the new look of the Business Report? It took me a while to get used to it, but actually I think it works.
That was a joint effort, mainly driven by Rolf, but it was in response to Louisiana Business Inc. conducted some focus groups. And what came back, a lot of things came back, but one of the things that came back is we had to come to grips with the fact that people consume news and information in a different way now than they used to. And so it was actually months of thought, and I came in the middle of that process, and in a nutshell, the idea was to have shorter, punchier items, more news you can use, and the way Rolf put it is, we're getting back to our roots, business to business.
297-5633 is your number, and David Donson, the executive editor of the Business Report in Louisiana Business, Inc., is our guest. He is a man who was here and came back, and as we know, quite often when people leave this community, they're gone for good, except for a few visits in LSU or Southern football games, and they're not around anymore. But David came back, and he is now the executive editor once again. The city has changed. The state has certainly evolved in the last 24 years, and now we're certainly a more conservative environment politically. You're smiling. Is that a surprise?
No, but for me, it was kind of the two bookends. I mean, Oregon, for heaven's sake, and then Louisiana, they're sort of at the opposite polar ends of mm-hmm. the spectrum, and I'm not sure that one is preferable to the other.
Okay. George asks about St. George. I don't think that George is the St. George, but about this proposed community. What do you think? Is this going to work, or is this a terrible idea?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm the one to ask about that. If you're asking from a business perspective, what that would mean, I got to tell you, Jim, from a business perspective, it would not be a calling card for Baton Rouge, because you know what the headlines would be nationally if there were a City of St. George Incorporated.
What do you think they would be?
Well, I think it would be along racial lines, and it would not be favorable.
It would not be favorable. A lot of people have to change their stationery, too. Perhaps even the business report.
That's right.
It'd be the St. George Business Report, right? But this is something that was the big story of the year last year. According to the Advocate, it was the biggest story of 2013, and it may very well be the biggest story of 2014. How do you see it playing out?
It's anybody's guess. I think that it's the recent developments have meaning. The annexations of the Mall of portions of the Mall of Louisiana, Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center, and Baton Rouge General has certainly changed the landscape. I don't think we know precisely what it means, but the proponents of the incorporation of St. George have been very forthcoming in saying this changes everything.
Well,
it could change everything.
Yeah, and I would think they've been out getting signatures. Now some of the people who signed up are probably no longer in St. George or the proposed community of St. George.
Well, and some of them are saying they've changed their minds.
Yeah, that's true, too. So it may be hard to get those 18,000 signatures.
Well, except that there's no time limit. They've got until the end of time to get those 18,000 signatures.
I think to get it on the ballot this year, though.
Oh, well, that's right.
They've got to move pretty quickly, and they may run out of time. And it is something that some people say the whole parish should vote upon. Do you think the whole parish should have a say in this?
You know, that's a question I'm not qualified to answer. I have lived in places where there were annexation votes, but it was strictly the people in the annexed area who had the right to decide that. I can't render an opinion on that. I think that would be for the courts to decide.
You did public relations for the Keystone Pipeline. In Louisiana, almost all lawmakers, including Senator Landrieu, are in favor of it. The president is not, at least not now. What do you think? Where is this going in your perspective? What would it do for the state?
I'm not sure that it has any direct impact on Louisiana, because most of the connections are going to be in Port Arthur and in Houston. So that oil is not likely to be refined in Louisiana. The ancillary benefits to Louisiana would be just the having access to a steady supply of non-conflict oil, if I may say so. And it's, you know, where do you want your oil to come from?
But environmental groups are saying that independent of where the oil comes from, it's not a good thing environmentally. Do they have a point?
They make that point. It's been studied for 5 years. There have been two final environmental impact statements conducted by the Department of State. And I got to tell you, Jim, I've gone through four environmental impact statements now, and it is not a walk in the park. Every aspect of your operation is examined, and the two final environmental impact statements that came back said that there would be no negative net impact from the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
You have described the environmental movement in Louisiana as weak.
Weak might be a strong. Well, I just don't see them. They seem to be, I'm coming from Portland and coming from a Keystone background where they were in my face every day.
And we've got the Green Army led by General Honoré, but beyond that?
They haven't contacted me.
297-5633. We'll go to the phone lines with David Donson, the executive editor of Louisiana Business Inc., when we return in 90 seconds on WRKI. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett producing. 297-5633 is your number. Inkstershow at WRKF.org if you'd like to engage us online. Our guest is David Donson, the executive editor of the Business Report, 225 in Register, the Daily Report. Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica. You're on the air with David Donson.
Hi. Our TOPS program is one of the few things in this state receive bipartisan support, but no one mentions the fact that we educate these kids, which is a great opportunity, and they leave the state. And my question to your guest is, what would have convinced him to stay, and what could stave off our brain drain?
That's a terrific question. What would have convinced me to stay? I think it was personal ambition that led me to D.C. I had this vision of taking Washington by storm. Washington didn't return the favor. But it's an excellent question. What can we do to keep our kids here? And as you point out, education is part of it, but also opportunities after education. And I hope, that what we're seeing now is an explosion of opportunity that's just going to build over the next years and decades.
How will that explosion manifest itself?
It's going to be the first tranche is going to be engineering jobs, and the pipeline at LSU is getting full now to meet those engineering positions. The second tranche is going to be the actual construction jobs. Now those are going to be temporary, but they always are, and that's not necessarily a problem. And then over the longer term, there's going to be the operators and the technicians who are going to have very well-paying jobs for the rest of their lives.
Talking with David Donson, the executive editor of the Business Report, Louisiana Business Inc. Now, the state is having this success economically with new businesses coming here and billions of dollars of investment, but yet the state budget is a mess. How can that be when there's success in one area, but when it comes to the government, it's really difficult to balance a budget right now?
It's tough. You've got competing interests, even though the pie hasn't gotten bigger yet. These jobs and these businesses really have not, no ground has been broken on this 80, 50, whatever number you want to use, billion dollars worth of construction. So the revenues really aren't there. They're still competing over not a meager pie, but it is a limited size pie.
James asks, what is your opinion, David, on the proposed rail system from Baton Rouge to New Orleans?
Having lived in two major metropolitan areas, Washington and Portland, that had light rail, and one, Houston, that did not, I got to tell you, you want light rail. You want rail between your urban centers.
297-5633, still time to get in before David Donson heads out and Adam Knapp comes in. But race is still an issue in Louisiana, and perhaps it always will, and it's not like it isn't an issue in other places. But how does it compare as far as racial attitudes and racial politics here and, say, in Portland?
This will sound contradictory, but everywhere I've been, racism has been a problem. At least in Louisiana, we acknowledge it, whereas I know, in Portland it's subterranean, that there's still the same issues with race, but they are submerged. Now, part of that is because Portland is 91% Caucasian. But racism is a problem we've got to deal with, and I would encourage people to read John Nolan's guest editorial in the current issue of Business Report, where he discusses that very thing.
In Portland, for example, do we have all white neighborhoods like we do in Baton Rouge?
Well, that it would be hard not to. Again, it's 91% Caucasian, 3% Asian, 3% Hispanic, 3% African American. So it's almost, statistically speaking, it would be difficult not to have all one race neighborhoods.
But in this area, we have them, and we've got a city that's at least half or more minority. So how does that happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I live in a condo just right near here, and two of my neighbors are of African-American heritage. I I don't know. I mean, I think it's has something to do with history.
I think it has a lot to do with history, but obviously it would seem that there is some concerted effort to keep neighborhoods white. And by the way, this isn't necessarily a liberal conservative issue. Jimmy Carter, when he ran for president in 1976, advocated what he called ethnic purity in neighborhoods. Obviously, he believed that neighborhoods, some of them, should be kept all white or all Italian or all Hispanic. He was an advocate of that. And some people, here we are, what, 38 years later, they have the same feeling that then Governor Carter of Georgia had in 1976.
I'm certainly not an advocate of ethnic purity, but I do know that the social experiments we have thus far tried, which include desegregation, really haven't done all that well.
Why do you think they haven't succeeded in your judgment, and I would say your judgment is shared by most?
I don't know about that, but I can tell you what I do know. I was in the first class that was integrated, desegregated in Shreveport, Louisiana, and now from the standpoint of time and maturity, I don't think they ever intended for it to work. They didn't do it at the beginning of a school year. They did it in the middle of a school year. They took all one-race school, shut it down. They lost their football team, their basketball team, their cheerleaders, their student body, their student council, everything, and grafted it onto an all-white school. It was intended to fail. They had what they called ability grouping. And what that meant was segregation inside the campus. I don't think they wanted it to work.
Where did you go to school?
This was in Captain Shreve High School in Caddo Parish, Louisiana.
Captain Shreve. You must have been in Shreveport not long after Terry Bradshaw and some
other. Terry Bradshaw.
Robert
you
Parrish.
Bet. You
yeah.
bet. Robert Parrish. What a great guy. Really nice guy.
Yeah.
Both of them are.
Well, Louisiana has certainly produced a number of prominent African-American people, and that's to its credit, but yet we have the highest rate of incarceration in the Western Hemisphere, and disproportionately African-American. Highest AIDS rate in America is right here in Baton Rouge. How do you cover those issues, or how will you cover them moving forward with the publications you have?
That's not really in our wheelhouse. We are business to business. I'm not saying that these aren't extremely important and thorny, almost intractable issues, but it's not something that is in our mainstream.
Education
would be. I know this is facile, Jim, but it's got to start with education. And when I say education, it's got to start in the home. And I think we have to heal the family, and we have to heal our racial wounds, and we have to figure this education thing out.
How do we do that?
If I knew that, they would erect a statue to me downtown, Jim.
But if you were governor or mayor, what would you advocate?
I would advocate best practices, looking around, seeing what Sarah Broom has done with Thrive, maybe something like that. But certainly the status quo is unacceptable.
And how bad is it?
Well, look around you. It's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you just pointed out the highest incarceration. We keep killing sex education, and yet we have the highest AIDS rate in the country.
It's usually the conservative lobby at the legislature that kills sex education. There was a bill that just got killed. Do you think that would be a good thing?
Well, of course, that was for the younger. Well, we do have sex education in the higher grades. I don't know. I don't know, Jim. But to in the face of the crisis we have, it does seem to be hiding our heads in the sand.
Well, David, we look forward to talking with you more often. Glad you're back, and it is a honor for our community that you chose to come back.
Thank you for having me on your show, Jim. I appreciate it.
Well, and we're going to be joined in just a moment by Adam Knapp, and I think that moment has come. The president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber of Commerce, and yesterday, the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board voted to oppose legislation to strip some of its power and that of Superintendent Bernard Taylor and hand it over to principals. It was a 9-0 vote with Barbara Freiberg and David Tatman abstaining, but The legislature appears inclined to go forward with this, and the governor of Louisiana has likely to sign it into law. Adam Knapp, your thoughts about the legislation.
Hey, Jim, thank you for having me on the air. The most important thing I wanted to kind of touch on first is the what drove the design of this legislation. Senator White, who is the author of the bill, worked with Representative Steve Carter and Representative Dalton Honoré to try to come together on a consensus of something that wasn't what Senator White has pushed in the last few years of a Southeast District pullout of just trying to do something in one part of the community, instead trying to do something that could work across the entire community, but responds to what is a tremendous amount of concern about the future of public education in the parish. I think there's a great deal of frustration, especially in the business community where I work at the chamber, that there's long been a need to do something different in the future of education. And although there have been efforts and strategies by the school system to try to make changes over the last number of years, little has actually been enacted or changed, and that's the frustration I think that Senator White has been trying to address for the southeast portion of the parish, and that Representative Carter and Honoré want to try to make possible for the rest of the parish something that could be a consensus that everybody can work together on. The idea was to not try to break up the district, but to try to do something that would empower neighborhoods and community schools in a manner that gives, in a large district like this is, more opportunity for parents to get engaged at the school and know that their principal can actually do something and change something. One of the teachers' associations that we know has used the phrase that there's a bit of a learned helplessness in the district, that what you find is that everybody wants to pass the buck up the chain, and it's oftentimes the example or the excuse you get is that, oh, I can't do anything, that's the central office. And this is a bill that says that decision-making really can be driven down into schools themselves in order to give principals the ability to do things as close as possible to the classroom, to make decisions as close as possible to the students themselves. That's the impetus of the bill and the design of the bill. And then in the details of it, it has a number of points that I think that are worth noting. It calls for neighborhood zones that are allow for cross-district enrollment still in magnet schools and programs that for special needs kids, kids with disabilities, alternative schools, those kinds of things. The bill also makes it possible to prioritize that folks can access the schools within different areas that they live to try to get more of a community feel in those areas, but that you have some school choice within those areas. And it also creates parental councils in each community, each of these neighborhood enrollment zones that the parents then have the ability to get much more engaged and communicate with their principals about the things that they see going on in each of these community zones.
Well, this resolution passed 9-0 by the school board says the bill violates Article 3, Section 12 of the state constitution, which bans the legislature from passing local or special laws regulating the management of parish or public city public schools. So it would seem that the school board might have a strong case here, Adam.
It's a very important question. I appreciate you bringing that one up. This is something that's been addressed a number of times in the education committees during the hearings. And the way that the Constitution treats this subject, of course, we wouldn't want to push a bill or advance a bill that is not going to be able to stand through the process. And so our earliest question to the bill's drafters were, is there a mechanism or a means of doing something in a statute related to school education? And the answer was yes. The means to doing so that the Constitution provides is to write a bill that can apply to other large school districts that at some point could apply. So the way that there is allowed in the statutes or the Constitution of the state allows for the legislature to draft bills that have consequence or could in the future have consequence for other school systems. The way the bill is drafted, and there's many other examples in state law of bills like this that relate to education that have a population reference that says if there are other districts that have this similar population size, this legislation can apply to those or could apply in the future. And there's a lot of language in the bill that describes how that should be construed. So if there are other large districts that have the same population or in the future have the same population, and have what we have in East Baton Rouge Parish is multiple independent school districts that affect the complexity of managing education in this situation. And so if other parishes have that same constraint, then they have this bill would apply to them.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Adam Knapp.
Yeah, as far as doing something different in education, you think making mandatory pre-K to get to those children who otherwise don't have a good learning environment at home, and also foster extracurricular, you know, hiring more teachers, especially in the arts, and provide transportation for the children who participate in that, and increase the tax to pay for all this.
Those are other issues, but do you share the same kind of approach that Dan would advocate?
Absolutely. He brings up three important points. The question of pre-K education is one that our organization has been strongly supportive of. We can see in the data from here and elsewhere that the earliest interventions in education, especially for at-risk students, low-income students, it has one of the greatest effects on their long-term outcomes. To be able to get them in an early pre-K. This bill has less to do with that topic, although the thought is the more that a principal can control their budget, they can determine how to make sure that they can offer those kinds of outcomes. On transportation, it absolutely addresses the need for transportation to be provided, and either the central office or the school system, the school principal can determine what's right for that. Those are things that the bill says that this would make it possible for principals to be able to direct more decision-making around those outcomes.
Adam is joined now by Albert in North Baton Rouge. Albert, good morning. You're on WRKF with Adam Knapp.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Knapp.
Good morning.
There are major problems with this bill, and I'm just going to mention three issues real quickly because I know that we're limited on time. East Baton Rouge is not a failing system. We are 4 points away from being rated a B system. Now, we have our issues to be sure, but your organization has played a leading role in spreading this misinformation throughout this community. I have a problem with that. Number two, no system in America gives principals the autonomy that this bill does. And what bothers me is the so-called educational reformers willfully ignore the science on what actually works in education. There are studies that show that there's no link between, there is no statistical link between giving principals more autonomy and student achievement.
All right. Would you respond? Thank you, Albert. Adam?
So these are two important points, and I appreciate Albert's comments. One, to the question of not being a failing system, the school system put out a report themselves about 3 weeks ago that they brought in a group called the Council of Great City Schools, and I would really encourage anyone that wants to understand the district's performance, especially related to subgroups, it's the best way to understand it, whether they are actually doing well or not. Most shocking thing, and this is a district, the EBR district put this out as a way to tout their performance. If you look at the actual data and the report that they put out, it actually is a district that is failing the vast majority of the kids that are in it, relative to other large urban school districts.
So 297-5633. We'll spend a few more minutes with Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. James on airline. James, good morning. You're on the air with Adam Knapp.
Thank you. I'm disappointed that Mr. Knapp is pushing a closed-door solution to questions that should be answered in the Democratic forum of a local school board meeting. But let me talk about my family's experience and relate that to the damage this bill would cause. When we first moved to Baton Rouge almost 20 years ago and my daughter was 2 years old, friends of ours noticed that she wasn't talking.
Yes.
And referred her to to the testing function in the central office.
And?
And they, I'm sorry, I'm hearing your producer at the same time. She was tested and placed at South Downs, a very excellent program. This bill would weaken central testing of at-risk kids. it would take away the funding South Downs needs. That child who was saved from a lifetime of speech difficulties by this excellent school system graduates with a bachelor's degree from Louisiana Tech next week.
All right. Adam, would you respond to James?
Sure, and thank you for the concern. And the bill in no way would change the ability for a school like South Downs to be funded the way it is. The bill describes the responsibility for the school system to create a funding formula that addresses the needs of students and of schools. In the current language, it basically says that the school board must come up with an equitable funding formula for schools. And that's about all it says. So it really doesn't affect it other than the board is in charge of sorting out the way that that should happen. To the question of it being a closed-door process, I think the reason for the legislative process being open and the committees allow for a lot of public input, and the authors have been very open and accessible to folks by email and by phone. They've been reaching out to a lot of folks to get input and have been trying to take a lot of conscientious input that folks have raised. They've made a number of amendments to the bill with those that have called them and made requests of them. So I think they continue to do that and will continue to do that through the remainder of the session.
All right, final question from a listener, and it's a good one, about the move by the Metro Council the other night to allow the annexation of the mall and the hospital, one of the hospitals in the proposed St. George area. Your thoughts about the move by the Metro Council?
I think it was a very important move for the community. I think the mall and the two hospitals that were requested, some of their property being annexed, are businesses, they're property owners, and they requested for their own business certainty to be in inside of the city so as to have some understanding of what their environment would be, where they're going to be doing business, and to have that stability. For them, that's the right answer, and they requested it, and it was nice to know that the Metro Council honored the business's request. What it does for the question of incorporation of a city, something that our organization has been against, is that it says that you would have less of those resources, those financial resources in the operation of the city. Our concern, of course, has been about education, that the debate has been more about the city in the last year than about what is the right direction and that is an option for education for the entire community, not just for a portion of the community. And that's where I think Senator White and Representative Carter and Honore have been focused.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it, Adam, and let's talk soon.
Thank you for having us on the air, Jim.
Take care. Bye. We're joined now for a few minutes by Earl Swift. He's written a compelling biography, The Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream, one of the most recognized and beloved cars to roll off an assembly line. The 57 Chevy was the embodiment of jet-age optimism in 1950s suburban America. Earl Swift, tell us about the fascinating history of the classic 57 Chevy.
Well, Jim, I guess I should point out that this is not the story of the 57 Chevy. It's the story of a single car and the 13 people who've owned it. And attempts more to tell the story of modern America, really, through this curious cross-section of humanity that shared this one vehicle.
Well, it is certainly symbolic of the 57 Chevy, though. 13 owners over, 57 years? So it's a car that has, to look at it, it's certainly a beautiful model, 1957. It has stood the test of time, and I think that it is one that evokes the spirit of that time.
No question. More so now maybe than at the time that it came out, because when the 57 Chevy rolled off the line, it was not an instant classic. It was not hailed as a particularly iconic design. It was kind of lost, really, if you read the literature, the automags and popular literature of the day. It was just one among a great many good-looking cars that came out in 1957, but it's acquired that patina of appreciation in the years since. The thing that is notable about the car at the center of this story is that this was not a fully loaded Bel Air. It was not a showpiece car by any means. This was a kind of an average midline 57 Chevy wagon of the sort that an average American would have bought, and in fact did buy, in 1957.
you started reporting on this more than 10 years ago.
Just about 10 years ago, yeah.
When did you realize you had enough material to write a full-bloom book about it?
Well, I mean, the idea came from having owned a lot of old cars myself, and by that I don't mean classics and restored beautiful cars. I mean beaters, especially in my 20s. And often back in those days, I'd find myself wondering what poor saps had owned these beaters before I had, and it was a pretty short leap from that kind of thinking to realizing that there might be a story, a bigger story, not so much a car story as a kind of an American story, and finding one car that had been owned by a lot of people and trying to trace its genealogy, as it were, you know, from beginning to end. And so in 2004, I attempted to do it, and at that point, I was able to trace this particular car back through 11 owners. That's how many it had at the time, and wrote a series for the newspaper I worked for in Norfolk, Virginia, that traced this car and kind of told a Virginia history through this one car. And it was not a book at that point. It just did not have the critical mass to translate into a 100,000-word narrative, and mostly because the 11 owners, all interesting in their own right, all really fascinating people, none of them was a big enough character, really, to propel, a big story. And I mean no disrespect when I say that, because I couldn't propel a story myself. I mean, uh-huh. I'm not a big enough character.
Well, who had the car? Had the car the longest among the 13 owners?
Well, the original owner had it for 15 years, a guy named Nicholas Thornhill, who was a boilermaker at the Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Portsmouth, Virginia. And he willed it to his grandson, who was a veterinarian, and he drove it for 3 years. So between them, the Thornhills had it for a third of its history, really.
When you see a 57 Chevy, what kind of image is conjured up in your mind?
Well, I think that you could catalog all the individual parts that make the car notable. I mean, it's got a lot of nods to military aviation. It's got mock machine gun sights slotted into its hood. It's got rubber warheads that jut from its grill. It's got those immense fins that kind of evoke a Cold War fighter plane. But really, the whole is greater than the sum of those parts, because what it all adds up to is, it's a very optimistic design. It was a design that was supposed to provoke in buyers of 1957 a kind of a joyful optimism about the future, about the jet age. And today, that same optimism translates as kind of a sweet nostalgia, almost a wistfulness. It seems almost naive. It's a bit over the top in many ways. It's a pretty busy design, but it's beautiful.
Well, you take us through the lives of these people and the lives of the automobile during a time in America that spans from Eisenhower to Obama. Much has changed, not only in the automotive world, but in the world at large in the last 57 years.
That's true. One thing hasn't changed, though, is that Americans are the most automotive people on the planet, and our cars are unlike any other possessions that we have. They're really more partners than possessions. You know, these are the descendants of our trusty steeds from the cowboy days, and you really don't see that change much over those 57 years. The car remains central to American life, and our relationship to it is kind of key to our identity.
Well, at one point there's a line, the 57 Chevy was pretty, and some of the owners were pretty, but some of them, it's certainly a wide array of people who owned this vehicle.
Yeah, well, it's true that some of the owners are not pretty. The 13th owner is a guy named Tommy Arnie, and he's really the main character of the main human character of the story. And he's a guy who is a fifth-grade dropout. He's been arrested 70-odd times. He's a felon. Functionally illiterate. But despite the fact that he had never cracked an American history book in his life, he bought this car knowing that it had been owned by 12 people before him, and really kind of attracted to the idea that it represented, it was a physical embodiment of a history that he could understand. And And he set about in 2009 trying to bring it back to life. And this is a guy who's he's the product of a restoration himself, really.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got this car, it was so far gone that if you had seen it at that point, Jim, you would have said, there's nothing left here to salvage, let alone save, because birds had nested in the seats. The engine hadn't turned over in years. The paint, what little remained, and there wasn't much, was cracked like a dry lake bed. Rust had punched its way through the, you know, very heavy gauge steel that makes up the body of the car. It was a complete wreck.
Well, the book is Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. 57 years of the Chevy that was iconic for its time and remains a part of our culture that has endured. And 13 different people have seen fit to do the TLC and all that is necessary to keep this car on the road. It's quite a ride from Earl Swift. Thank you, Mr. Swift. Good to visit with you, and we look forward to another visit sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Take care.
Have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we're joined now in studio by Pam Vincey, the curator of the LSU Textile Museum, and her partner in crime, Joy Smith. And the Textile Museum is one of the treasures on the LSU campus. And for those unfamiliar, Pam, it's located not too far from the Union.
That's correct. On Tower Drive, but at the South Campus crossing, just behind the Union.
Well, for people during the year, if they want to come by and see what's there, do they have that opportunity?
They certainly do. We have ample parking around the perimeter of LSU, and we'd love, you know, to have visitors 8 to 4:30, 5 days a week.
And this is a big time of the year.
Today is especially a big time for LSU, and tomorrow for the museum and its Friends Support Group.
And why is it a big time? It's graduation.
Correct. And then tomorrow, though, the Friends of the Textile and Costume Museum, who provide such support for the museum, are having a sale, Friends Sale Donation Day.
All right, and Joy is involved with that. Joy Smith, what's going to happen tomorrow?
Tomorrow we have people from the community who will be bringing us their gently worn, wonderful clothing that we will have at our sale in November. November 15th is our sale, and we have two more take-in days after tomorrow. We have one in July and one in September. And most people wear 10% of their closet 80% of the time, so we're asking those people to go through that 90% and select items that they're not wearing, that's crowding their closets, and to donate them to our great cause.
And to come to the museum.
Right, exactly.
And tomorrow you get started at what time?
We start at 10 o'clock, yeah. 10 to 4 yeah. tomorrow. And we have a storage room on the third floor of the School of Human Ecology where the museum is housed. And so we organize by rolling racks, and we set up designer departments and purple and gold. And
there you go. Well, during the year, you have exhibits, but what generally do you put on display for people who want to come by and take a look?
Exhibitions range a great variety of topics covered, from archaeological textiles to modern fashion. In fact, the one that's currently being mounted focuses on the Department of Textiles, Apparel Design, and Merchandising on our students' organization called Hemline at LSU. And this is a student group that's active in promoting student design work as well as community service. So this is an exhibition that will focus on that group, highlight them for mm-hmm. what they do.
And you've been there how many years, Pam?
Jim. A wonderful probably 30 years.
Well, during that
maybe.
Time, you've had an amazing array of exhibits, haven't you?
Yes, we have.
What were some of the most memorable ones?
It's been important for the museum to feature graduate student dissertation research, and those have ranged from the use of commodity bags or feed sacks converted to clothing in the 1930s and 40s to archaeological textiles that are, you know, have local provenance and dissertation students have studied. So a great variety.
Has been a passion for you as well.
Oh, it has. I'm a graduate of the School of LSU Human Ecology, formerly known as Home Economics, and fashion merchandising, so it is a great passion for me.
Well, for those who would like some more information about tomorrow and throughout the year, what's the best number to reach the museum?
578-225-578-2281.
578-2281.
Yes.
And ask for Pam.
Yes.
Pam right. Vincey and Joy Smith, thank you so much, and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you, Jim.
And thank you for listening, everybody. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.